Thank you for joining us and welcome to another edition of Answers Network. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and if you just learned about this show, it is on the air for you by bringing on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising your family, your business, your life to a level that allows you to feel happier, healthier, and more successful. And remember, if you can't listen live, go to our website at answers.network and browse through a variety of heartfelt and enlightening topics. I'm confident that you'll find something that will bring greater joy to your life. Now, I also have a favor to ask. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group and to someone you know who can benefit from a particular subject. This is a powerful way that we can make a positive influence in the world together. And I guarantee you that the subject that we have today is something that we all know somebody can benefit from, because we all can. Our guest, Dr. Thomas R. Vernet, is a clinical psychiatrist who has taught at Harvard University, the University of Toronto, York University, and St. Mary's University. He is the author of 8 books, including The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, which was published in 27 countries, and he has authored 47 scientific papers. Our topic today is based on his latest book, The Embodied Mind, Understanding the Mysteries of Cellular Memory, Consciousness, and Our Bodies. Now, this is a breakthrough book, in my opinion, that promises to shift our understanding of the mind-brain connection, and it will reveal the mind's relationship with our bodies. Is the mind within our brain? Well, our guest says this is a very limiting belief, so let's dive in. Thomas, welcome to Answers Network.
Thank you, Alan. It's a real pleasure to be here.
All right. Now, I'm having a little trouble hearing you. So,
my goodness, let's not have that. How is this?
So I think that's a little better. Let's start in. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to this belief that there is a lot more than just what our mind is, and that there's this incredible connection with our body.
Well, thank you. That's a deep question. I guess I should go back to my youth. When I was very young, when I was 13 years old, actually, I read for the first time Freud's Interpretation of Dreams. And I was really, really turned on by that. I just thought that I loved that logical kind of unraveling, deep kind of a dissection of the unconscious. And so at that point, I made up my mind that I would become a psychiatrist. And so I did. And very early on, well, about 2 or 3 years after I started my practice, I had a young man in my office, and we were discussing a dream. And suddenly, his whole expression changed, and he started crying like a little baby. Mm-hmm. And so he continued like that for about 10 minutes, and then he came out of it. And then, being a somewhat skeptical young lawyer, said, you know, I just found myself in a crib and I was crying for my mother, but the crib that I found myself in was white. I swear it was white. But I've actually seen pictures of myself as a baby and they were in a blue crib. So something here doesn't add up. So I asked him to go home, talk to his mother. He was still a young man. His mother was still alive. Came back the next week. And he said, you know, this is amazing, but it seems that the first couple of months of my life, my parents did not have enough money to buy me a crib, and they borrowed a crib. Mm-hmm. And the borrowed crib in which I lay was white. And only 2 or 3 months later did they buy me a new crib, which was blue, and that's the one that all the pictures were taken with.
But yet not what your memory remember?
Well, his memory was better than any of the photographs, right?
Right.
So, and there was no way that he would have known that. Like, there's no way, you know, parents don't tell you about, oh, when you were a baby, you had a white crib. I mean, you know, really, who does that, right? So, but, you know, I was very well educated. I went, as you said, to the University of Toronto. I went to Harvard. And we were always taught that children before the age of two could not remember anything. So, naturally, I kind of sort of, you know, put it out of my mind. But then over the next few months, I had many more experiences sort of in a similar vein in other areas of life. We don't have to go into it, but there were enough experiences like that, enough events to give me a pause. And so I thought, well, I will start looking into it. And I started doing research in the literature, in the medical literature, to see whether other people have had experiences like that, and how could this be possible scientifically. And so I wrote a paper, and you know, before we started this program, you and I were talking about the fact that you're interested in how people become successful. Mm-hmm. So I will tell you how I became successful. So I wrote this paper, and it was called The Psychic Life of the Unborn Child. And I put in everything that at that time, this is, we are talking about, we are talking 1978. Mm-hmm. Everything which at that time was known about the unborn child in terms of its neurological development. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge conference in Rome, the World Congress on Psychosomatic Obstetrics and Gynecology. And so I sent in my paper, and lo and behold, it was accepted. And this is where luck comes in. There is a combination of luck, knowledge, and hard work. And so I was very lucky. I was put on the main program in the morning with some of the absolutely leading lights in psychosomatic obstetrics and gynecology. And I don't know whether you have ever heard of Ronnie Lang, the psychiatrist, Scottish psychiatrist, Ronnie Lang, very, very famous at that time. Well, anyway, I was on that program. I was given 20 minutes. I read my paper, and I immediately noticed that there was this tremendous excitement, like there were 600 people there. Mm-hmm. They were incredibly excited, like the idea that the unborn child really had, you know, some sensate being, some consciousness, some memory, was just electrifying. So I said to the people there, if at the end of the day, today at 5 o'clock, I'm in room 525, please come and see me if you're interested in pursuing this. So at 5 o'clock, there was this huge lineup of people. And wow. So I got to meet personally many of these wonderful, wonderful scientists. And so it was at that point then that I made up my mind that I would write this book, which you mentioned, which has been an incredible success, The Secret Life of the Unborn Child. And so having written that, I was able to show scientifically proven that children from the age of about 6 months after conception, in other words, at the end of the second trimester, are really sensitive, sensate, conscious, and remembering little beings. Obviously, you know, in a primitive way, but there is some memory there, and we can prove that. But having written that book and, you know, seeing it translated and talking about it all over the world, as I have been asked to do, I was always bothered by one thing. And that was that although I had very good scientific studies to back up my contention that from the age of 6 months after conception, children can remember things, I didn't have anything to back up stories, anecdotes, clinical case histories of people who seem to remember things that happened to them before the age of 6 months after conception. So that always bothered me because I didn't think, and I don't think, that people make up these stories. Like, you know, they really happened. But how to explain it scientifically? So 7 years ago, I read this scientific paper, and in it, the doctor who wrote it described a 44-year-old Frenchman mm-hmm. to see his GP because he had a weakness in his left leg. And they did all kinds of tests, and to their absolute astonishment, they found that the man had virtually no brain tissue. He had a thin crescent of cerebral tissue, and the rest of his skull was filled with cerebrospinal fluid. We call it hydrocephalus in medicine, just water on the brain. Now, this man, as I said, was a 44-year-old Frenchman. He was married, had 2 children, and he was gainfully employed in the French civil service. So I thought about that, and I thought, how is this possible? How can a man function so well in society with virtually no brain? And so that's when I started once again, you know, looking into the literature, and I found actually a great deal of information about people who have had half of their brain removed, more than half of their brain removed, particularly children, for various reasons. And so that's when I started looking into the possibility that the brain is important, of course, but the rest of the body is also important. So that I have really substituted the idea of the enskulled brain with the idea of the embodied brain, meaning that all the cells in the body contribute to what we call the mind and cognition and memory and all the other things that we have only ascribed to the brain and not to the rest of the body.
Well, I'll tell you what you've done for me. You have now caused my brain to struggle with 2 things. Because one is that my great interest in this and wanting to go on to my, you know, my many questions that I have about this. And then the other side of my brain that is much more humorous, that when you ask the question that you thought, you know, how could this person be functioning literally without a brain? And the thought that went through my mind was, maybe he wants to run for office. Political office, okay. So I needed to get that out, okay. But at the same time, I mean, I'm so interested in the, you know, the mind body connection. Yes. So you wrote this book. This yes. gathered a lot of information about like our early brain function. More recently, now, what prompted you to write The Embodied Mind, so that you can now deal with, I guess, you know, older brains and talk about how the connections are with other parts of our body?
Well, you know, speaking of older brains, let's pick up on that. Every pharmaceutical company in the world, I think, is trying to find an answer to Alzheimer's disease, trying to mm-hmm.
yeah.
trying to treat it, right?
Yes.
And of course, all of them, because we are in this culture of brain and head, all of them are looking at the brain as the seat where the answers must be found, right?
Right.
Well, in some way, wrong. Mm-hmm. Because interestingly enough, you know, what is amazing is that, for example, a university in Australia, for example, has found that I'm just looking up the exact name, but I can't find it right now. Anyway, university in Australia has found that the amyloid T tissue, which is sort of the problem in terms of Alzheimer's disease, actually a lot of amyloid proteins are produced in the liver. And it is from the liver that they are being sent to the brain. So rather than looking for the answers in the brain in terms of Alzheimer's, what we should be doing is looking in the rest of the body. And so, for example, in the liver. So this kind of a blinketed approach to health has not done us any good. We have to really kind of have a wider perspective and understand that, you know, the rest of the body contributes tremendously to what goes on in the brain. And the brain, of course, contributes to what goes on in the rest of the body. It is an interconnected system that is functioning all the time simultaneously. It's not that one starts and the other one comes in. It's not cause and effect. It's like more a circular kind of emotion where everything is interconnected. So, you know, that's just one example of how things that happen below the neck can affect what happens above the neck.
Let me see if I'm interpreting this correctly. So what you're saying is you could have somebody that has brain fog,
yes,
and that what might end up helping them is to have a liver flush because they have a fatty liver issue.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay,
that's one of the many things that can happen. What is really, really important is look at the gut. The bacteria in the gut, the bacteria and viruses in the gut weigh about 5 pounds. People don't realize, you know, how much we carry, how many of these bacteria we carry in our gut. And they are tremendously important in so many, many different ways. I don't know about you, but I think there are millions of Americans and Canadians, including myself, who take simvastatin, which is an anti-cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
Well, some people benefit from it, not everybody. And the reason that not everybody benefits from it is because there are bacteria in, some people carry bacteria in their gut, which actually destroy the simvastatin. And unless you know that, and unless doctors find ways of testing your gut microbiome, which is what it's called, all the conglomeration and community of viruses and bacteria, unless they test it, many of the drugs that we are giving, simvastatin is just one, antidepressants is another class of drugs which do not work on a lot of people. And so doctors just kind of, you know, throw up their hands and say, well, I guess we'll just have to try another one. No, if this one doesn't work. We could save ourselves a great deal of money and a great deal of trouble if we just tested the gut microbiome, and then we would know which drugs will work and which drugs will have no effect on you. So the gut microbiome is incredibly important, incredibly important. May I give you just one other example?
Oh, please do.
Okay, well, this is absolutely fascinating. It's been found that, you know, older people deteriorate if they don't have good social relations. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
Social interaction is incredibly important for everybody, but especially old people. Well, it has been found that older people who sort of withdraw from society have a much different gut microbiome from people who interact more with others. And so it is not clear at the moment which came first, whether it's the gut microbiome that changes and makes you less socially mobile, or whether it's interacting less with people, which then changes your gut microbiome. We don't know. But The fact is that the two are connected, And once again, if we could look at that, we could make a huge difference to these older people. Because if we can change, if we can increase the diversity of the microbiome, that's the sort of secret word, diversity. Mm-hmm. If we can increase the diversity of the microbiome, we increase their social interactions, and they will be happier, they will be healthier, they will die, you know, at a much later date.
You know, one of the things in your book that I thought was really interesting, and you had it as sort of a core concept, is the existence of cellular intelligence. Share a little bit more about that and what you mean by it.
I think that's a very important concept. But again, a lot of people don't realize is that evolution, you know, has not taken us in a few years or perhaps a thousand years, whatever, from unicellular organisms to who we are today, like, you know, the complex human beings that we are today. It has taken millennia and millennia and millennia, God knows how long, but certainly, you know, millions of years to develop. And what has happened in terms of evolution is that evolution has kept all the little bits that worked at a lower level, as they increase, as evolution increased the complexity of life on Earth. So everything that worked in unicellular organisms, the very first living propagating organisms, really still works in us. It's just that it has become much more complex. So it pays to study very simple organisms because they tell us a lot about ourselves. So that's what I have done over the last 7 years and describe in my book. So in terms of cellular intelligence, many scientists have looked at bacterial films, for example, which are communities of bacteria. And they have stated and found evidence for the fact that bacteria in communities communicate very much like neurons communicate with each other in terms of potassium electrons, negatively charged potassium ions. They communicate with each other, and some scientists have even talked about some basic cognition in bacterial cells. If you look at a unicellular organism, such as the slime mold, for example, or the paramecium, slime molds are truly, truly incredibly intelligent. All kinds of experiments have been done on slime molds. Slime molds have no neurons and, of course, no brain. It's just a unicellular organism. And yet, you can train it to go through mazes. It learns how to get through a maze. When it comes to a dead end, it will leave behind some kind of a marker so that it knows that next time that is not the way to go. And also, slime molds can find the shortest distance between two pieces of food, let's say, whatever it is that they eat. But the fact is that they are incredibly, incredibly intelligent. And so when you see that happening, and then when you study cells, coming back now to human cells have all that intelligence that the slime mold has, plus much more, because they are much, much, much more complicated. So the only human cell that is visible to the naked eye is the dot, is as large as a period on a painted on a printed page. All the other cells are so small that you cannot see them with the naked eye, and yet they contain an incredible amount of stuff. You know, There's, of course, you know, the nucleus with the DNA. There are 37 what's called organelles, including the mitochondria, which are sort of like the lungs of the cell. And then there is the cell membrane, which a lot of people have ascribed to functions such as memory and the brain. It's sort of like the brain of the cell. But of course, inside the cell is the DNA, which contains all the information about the rest of the body, you know, like what, you know, which part of you is going to brain is going to grow a liver, which part of you is going to grow into a kidney, all that kind of floor plan for the organism is in the DNA. So I look upon the body and the cells in the body, millions and millions of cells in the body, a little bit like the way, for example, the New York Philharmonic plays. You will have, let's say, 120 different musicians, right? One conductor. And each musician is a different instrument. Each of them plays perhaps a somewhat different note. But when you are sitting in the audience, you don't hear 120 notes. You don't hear 120 right. musicians playing. You hear one sound. And that's what happens to our brain. I see the brain as kind of a conductor who is in charge and coordinates everything. Yes, very important. But the information comes from every cell in the body. Every cell in the body contributes to that. And the other thing that's very important to realize is, you know, that a lot of neuroscientists, some of the leading people in neuroscience, have spoken of the mind as an epiphenomenon, in other words, a function of the brain. They look upon the mind as a function of the brain. The same way, for example, urine is a function of the kidneys. Now, stop and think about that. You can see how nonsensical this statement really is, because the mind is not in any way comparable to the urine or, you know, or the gallbladder with producing bile or any of the other organs that we have which produce stuff. No, it's very, very, very different. So again, I think that it's not the brain that produces the mind, it's the whole body that produces the mind, and probably something else. And then we get, you know, into more metaphysical areas. But I think the important thing to realize is that there's not only is there research in terms of hydrocephalus, which I spoke about before, but there's also research, for example, on near-death experiences, NDEs, near-death experiences, right? And for example, I don't know whether you have ever heard of Dr. Bruce Grayson, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry,
yes, yeah.
University of Virginia Medical School. If you, I think he would be a great, great person to interview. He has written a book, After A Doctor Explores What Near-Death Experiences Reveal About Life and Beyond. And he has, and others have, but he's the one sort of that comes to my mind. Others have demonstrated, and in fact, I had an experience with that myself with one of my patients, where the person stopped, the heart stops beating, the brain for all intents and purposes stops working. But when the person comes back to life, perhaps 5-10 minutes later, after they have been practically dead, they will remember, they will tell you what happened in the room with great precision. And they will tell you things that there is no way they could have known unless they were sort of like almost hovering over themselves, perhaps 3 or 4 feet above where their body was lying. So, you know, this takes us, like I said, into more metaphysical areas. But the important thing to realize is that the brain is not alone in terms of producing the mind.
Exactly. And which takes us to the title of the book. The book is called The Embodied Mind, Understanding the Mysteries of Cellular Memory, Consciousness, and Our Bodies. And we're speaking with the author, Dr. Thomas R. Vernet, and we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You're listening to or watching Answers Network.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service, licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. We are talking about the embodied mind. Now, what I'd like to touch on a little bit is, you know, that we're taught that our memories are all stored in our brain. But after reading your book, you have a different view. So share with us a little bit about that.
Well, the view that I have is that memories are contained all over the body, in every cell, every tissue, every organ. And one of the ways in which this can be demonstrated is by heart transplants. You have heard, I'm sure, about cases of heart transplants where the person who received it, the recipient of the heart transplant, started to develop certain likes, dislikes, personality characteristics, which were those of the donor, and totally changed his or her life, the recipient's life. For example, there is the case of a young woman who was a vegetarian and who was only interested in her own gender in terms of being attracted sexually only to other women. She got the heart transplant. She didn't know who the donor was, but suddenly she started liking meat and she became totally heterosexual. There are many, many, many examples of that, of developing a different taste in music, a different taste in food, being attracted to different types of people. All kinds of things like that have been demonstrated. And the only explanation for that is that with transplanting the heart from another individual, you also transplanted memories and personality characteristics of that other person with the heart. Now, you know, I mentioned this to a couple of cardiac surgeons, and they were just horrified. I said, well, do you ever tell your patients who are about to get a heart transplant that they might experience change in personality? And they said, oh no, we would never do that.
Well, I read, while researching this show, I read a story of a man who, after receiving a heart transplant, ended up marrying the widow of the man that he received the heart from, because when he met her, he fell in love.
Yes.
I mean, talk about, you know, your heart carrying a memory.
I think that was
an incredible story.
Yes.
So yes, I mean, there has to be something to that.
I agree. Now, I had a letter from a woman in the United States who said that reading my book really made her feel much closer to her son, because her son had passed away. But reading my book, she knew that when she was pregnant with her son, some of his cells entered her body through the umbilical circulation. It's called microchimerism. And some of the mother's blood cells, of course, will continue in the child's body. But every mother who has ever been pregnant also carries in her body some cells from her baby or babies, if she had more than one. So this lady said that it really made her feel that somehow in her heart, she still carries part of her son, and she didn't feel so totally separated from him. And I thought that that was a very interesting, I mean, I never had that I never had that thought until I got the letter from that particular woman, but I think it's an interesting thought.
Wow, certainly is. Yeah. Now we have some comments and questions that have been sent in. And this one, and again, I want to thank those that take the time to do this. We really appreciate it. And I know that there are people that are working in the middle of the day. They can't listen live. So I think it's great that they're so interested that they'll send in a question ahead of time and listen to the answer later. This one reads, I am so excited to read your book as I have a great interest in the cellular memory, as well as morphogenetic fields as they apply to regeneration and healing. I would like to know if you have any opinion on how quantum tunneling can generate genetic mutations. These are very complex topics with many tangling strings to tie together. And this is from Richard in Oregon. And I should say, as you're explaining it, try and explain it to where we can all understand and not just Richard.
I think Richard might know more about this than I do. Yeah. Quantum tunneling is essentially a way in which cells communicate with each other. And that is a very important aspect, actually, of my book, because just like I told you about the bacteria, you know, in films, for example, with each other, it's the same thing with cells. And so I think we can go in so many different ways. Will you repeat a question for me again, please?
It says, I'd like to know if you have an opinion on how quantum tunneling can generate genetic mutations.
Right. Yes. Well, I don't know about genetic mutations. What is important about genetics is that there's this whole new science of epigenetics. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Epi means on top of, you know, like epiphenomenon. And so what we have discovered in epigenetics, and this is incredibly important, what we have discovered is that genes are not your destiny, that only 5% of the actual human genome is made up of genes. And the other 95% is made up of marks, ethyl and methyl groups, which act like switches. And it is the environment which influences which switches are on and which are off. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the genetic code itself is changed. It is the expression, the activation of the genes, which makes a difference. So you and I, we may have, both of us, you know, may have, for example, a gene that will promote Alzheimer's disease, just as an example. Okay. But if we live in an environment which does not support the turning on of that gene, if in fact it supports the deactivation, putting to sleep, so to speak, of that gene, then we'll never develop Alzheimer's. So, what is incredibly important about this whole idea of switches, of methyl and acetyl groups switching genes on, is that we can we can avoid lifestyles and we can avoid environment, toxic environments, for example, you know, being exposed to carbon monoxide, being exposed to toxic air, not smoking cigarettes, you know, things like that. By avoiding that, we avoid turning on the bad genes and we support the good genes. So in terms of your person calling in from Oregon, is it?
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So your Oregon guy, I think what's important to point out here is that you are not creating differences in the genes. You are only creating expressions, whether they are asleep or whether they are activated, and that makes all the difference. I don't know whether you have ever heard of Robert Sapolsky. He's a professor in California.
That sounds familiar.
He has written this incredible book. He wrote this book, which is called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, Sapolsky. Very, very famous guy out in California. And what he has pointed out is that our genome, it's like a book that has 5 pages of content and 95 pages of instruction on how to read those 5 pages. So that's what the switches do. It's 95 pages of switches and 5 pages of genes. And so, that's why how we live makes such a difference.
And I couldn't agree more, but let's take that one subject. I think we're at a time in society when I think everybody knows someone or has lost someone to some form of dementia or Alzheimer's.
Or cancer.
Yeah. So what would be something that most people can do? So what you were saying is that, so there are some people that may have a switch in there, either genetically left in them. So what would be some of the things that they can do to make sure that they don't turn on that switch?
Yeah, that's a very good question, very relevant. One of the most important things they can do is exercise. It's amazing how important even a little exercise, 10 minutes a day, go for a quick walk, will make a difference in your life. Being exposed to nature is very, very, very beneficial. I remember a study where they looked at people who had cardiac surgery, and they put 10 people into rooms which overlooked a park, and 10 people into a room which just looked at a blank wall, some kind of a brick wall. People who looked out the window at the park recovered twice as fast as the people who only had to look at a brick wall.
Actually, I think I remember reading that one.
Yeah, it's so simple. It makes so much sense. But again, you know, sometimes if it's simple and if it doesn't cost money, people don't do it.
All right. Well, so we've got exercise, we've got nature, both of which I completely agree with. What would be a couple of more things that you would suggest?
Yes, stress. Avoid stress.
Reduce stress.
Stress kills. You need anything to avoid stress. I just drove down to Connecticut this past weekend to visit my great-granddaughter, which was fun. But I tell you, driving down was awful, just awful. Trucks everywhere on the highway. Then there were roadblocks. Then there were accidents. Then at one point, it rained like it has never rained in my life before. You could hardly see in front of the car. It was so stressful. So stressful. My wife and I said, we'll never do this again. This is just too stressful. I'm sure that a few of my bad genes got turned on undergoing that trip. So stress, yes, avoid stress. Engage in activities which you enjoy.
Okay.
very, very important. You know, bring laughter into your life. Bring joy into your life. Bring music and dancing, if you can, into your life. Good friends, very important. Social interactions. Then keep your mind as active as possible. I play chess. I love playing chess. Playing cards is good. Bridge or chess are good games because you really got to think hard. And that's good. Doing crossword puzzles is good. Reading is good. Don't withdraw from life. Be part of life, and you will do much better.
All right. Now, we have another question coming in, and this one reads, please share with us your thoughts on the long-term effects of mRNA vaccines on the body's genome. It says there have been so many claims that have since been proven to be false about its safety and efficacy, especially new statistics on organ and immunity system damage. It says it's called a gene editing technology slash therapy, but how does it align with epigenetics discussions? And this is from Henry in California.
Well, I must say you have some very, very intelligent and very knowledgeable listeners. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, really. That's congratulations to you on that. You deserve credit. I think that I would really like to avoid that. It's beyond my area of expertise. I'm not very knowledgeable about viruses and all these vaccines and this whole controversy about whether they are helpful or not and what they do to the body. It's just beyond my area of expertise. I would really like to pass on that.
No problem. And so what I would like to touch on, and we've got about 2.5 minutes,
okay,
which is, you know, you talk about the bacteria in our gut, how important it is. We're obviously now starting to read a lot about it. And you claim that, you know, the microbiome, you know, aids us,
yes,
with much, much more than just digestion. Yes. What are some of the things, okay, other than, I mean, obviously, people, you buy the book and you can learn a lot of this yourself. But what are some of the things that people can do? Because I know that there are many people that I know that have been ill and they've been given an antibacterial medication that may be taking out whatever that bad bacteria is, but now it's taking out the good bacteria as well. And they now are finding that they're having different problems. What are some of the things that people can do to avoid that?
I think I'm going to go out on a limb and say that any doctor who prescribes antibiotics without at the same time telling patients to take yogurt or to take, you know, other foodstuffs that create good bacteria is not doing a proper job.
Okay.
Every time you take antibiotics, you've got to take yogurt, you got to take all kinds of, I'm not familiar with all the other foods, but, you know, like sauerkraut, for example, foods that contain a lot of bacteria. And if you can't do that, well, just go to the pharmacy, go to your, drugstore and buy pills that contain extra bacteria. You can buy 12 million bacteria in a pill quite easily. And so I think that is incredibly important. And also try to eat a varied diet. Okay, don't every day eat the same stuff. The more you vary your diet, the more interesting bacteria you will have in your gut and the healthier your body and mind are going to be.
Thomas, thank you so much. And again, for everybody out there, the book is The Embodied Mind, Understanding the Mysteries of Cellular Memory, Consciousness, and Our Bodies. So Thomas, can I assume they can get the book at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold?
Absolutely.
Okay. Great. And if anybody would like to get in touch with you personally, is there a way you would like to offer that to them?
Yes. Just let them visit my website, trvernymd.com.
Okay. So that was T as in Tom,
R as in Robert,
Verny, V-E-R-N-Y.
M-D, sorry. There's an M-D.
M-D.
Dot com.
Yeah. Or just dot com.
Just dot com, yeah.
Okay. Great. And if anybody's driving out there, if you didn't get a chance to write that down, we will make sure that it is on our website at answers.network. Thomas, thank you so much. I would love to stay in touch.
Yes, please do. Please do. So would I. Really. Yes. I mean it. Yes.
Yes. So, and again, thank you so much for all of your work. I think you're making a positive difference in the world, and that's exactly what we need more of.
Thank you, and so are you.
Thank you. All right. Now, for everybody out there, please, next week, you can join us because we're going to be looking into and meeting with research psychologist and media analyst Frieda Birnbaum, PhD. And she's going to share her perspective on two very important questions. Does violent television shows and movies trigger real violence? And what about video games? So we're going to discuss those things, especially those of you with young children that are making decisions on what you want them to watch. Check with us and we'll be able to tell you what Frieda believes and what she has come up with her research. For everybody out there, also, please visit our archives of past interviews at answers.network or just subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, SoundCloud, YouTube. Now, YouTube, you'll get to see us. A lot of the other ones, you'll just get to listen. We're also on Facebook Live on LA Talk Radio for those of you that are watching it right now. We really appreciate it very much. And the next time you're on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, please stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and spread the word. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers Network.
You're listening to Answers Network with Alan Cardoza, only on LA Talk Radio.